Colonel White, real toe.
Flamethrowers, reserve ammunition and grain for the mules to feed on. Individuals, including the commanding officer, had to carry all their sleeping gear, their weapons, ammunition, and they weighed 60 pounds. At the end of 5 days, when you'd eaten your 5 days' ration, they went down to 50 pounds, and then they became 60 pounds again. Food was dropped by air, of course, and though we walked in on foot from 16th Brigade, from the Lido Road, our other chaps we knew were going from a different place in by glider and Dakota to arrive in the indoor area about the same time as us. We knew as we went down through the jungle in single file each day what the next day would be. And a typical day was up at 5:30 in the dark. Saddle the mules and load them in the dark. Move off from the defensive bivouac 5 minutes before first light in single file with a team of slashers in front to make a path roughly wide enough for men and mules to pass through. After 30 minutes, we had a halt to tighten the saddle girths of the mules who'd been making smells during the last 10 minutes as hard as they could. We tightened the girth straps, and then we walked 2 hours and had breakfast.
You were telling me earlier that the mules were very cunning in this way.
Yes, the mules didn't like to have their straps tightened on them when they were first loaded. And so they blew themselves up. After about 20 minutes, they couldn't stand all this air inside them, and they blew it out again. And I can still smell what happened when they blew the air out.
How did they blow themselves up, though? By eating too much, or what?
By gulping air. I haven't tried it myself. Then after breakfast, we walked for 4 hours, and then had a midday break, because midday is the perfect time for signals between our sets in the jungle and our rear headquarters in Assam. After the midday break, we walked another 4 hours until it was dark, and then we moved off any track, animal or villager's track, into a defensive perimeter for the night, where we slept, ate and rested in pairs. So each day, with that 60-pound load, you had at least 10 hours walking. And that was where our intense training in September, October, November, December 43 came in, because of all things that training was supposed to do, it was first of all to harden you for carrying a load. And I well remember our troops found that in the early days of training their bones were aching most of the night, and they slept very badly. But after a month or two of training, you could sleep without your bones rebelling. Of course, the second thing about training, obviously, was, probably the most important thing, was to become jungle wise, to know how to live, operate, and realize the jungle is your friend if you're able to operate in it. I well remember on one of these typical days where we were taking a supply drop on the Uyu River, and naturally many of the parachutes got hooked up in trees, and I was, well, I'll say I was stupid, insisted on climbing the most difficult trees because I thought my training had helped me, having had proper physical training before the war, and so I insisted on climbing the most difficult trees. This was my undoing on the Uyu River, because I cut down the ropes holding one of the parachutes, and a pack of 120 pounds hit me in the chest, dropped me upside down on the floor, and I broke my arm, my left arm. The next day, a light plane arrived to evacuate a casualty, and my column commander said, "You're the other one going out. Your arm's in plaster, you're no good." And I refused to go out.
Why was that?
I don't know, but I would have never able to hold my head again if I'd taken this opportunity of getting out and leaving my comrades to go on fighting. Apart from that, I wanted to go and fight. I wanted to see what it was like to do a bayonet charge. And sure enough, we did. And I found out later on.
But do you think the others would have made adverse comments if you had gone out?
A lot of them thought I was an idiot for not taking the opportunity. But I don't think they really did. And I know, I so loved my rifle company, I know they would be happy to have me stay with them.
Which arm was injured?
Left arm, which meant that I could rest my Sten gun on my plaster Paris on my left arm and still fire it. So there was no problem. After 55 days of walking with these wretched loads on your back, at last we got near to the area where we were going to fight the Japs. Our first meeting where we were going to hit the Japs was at a place called Indore. And we arrived on the outskirts of a village called Thetkajin, which I have looked at today, and I see marked on my escape map, which was a silk map which could be used by anyone who was lost. Outside Thetkajin, we ran into our first hostile lot of Japs. We had a number of casualties that morning, and finally I decided the only way was to do a bayonet charge. So we crept up to within 30 yards, and we could still only vaguely see them because there were thin scrub and jungle everywhere. We fixed bayonets, and I had the happy moment of seeing the Japs get up out of their trenches and run. Somehow those last 5 to 10 yards before we met them, it broke their spirit and they ran. And our Japs all cheered. We couldn't help it.
Were any of them bayoneted?
No, the Japanese had no loads, and they had little PT shoes on. They were able to run far faster than we could with all our kit on us.
Were you making any noise as you charged?
During the last 10 yards, we shouted at the top of our voices. We just shouted. We weren't shouting any words, just shouted at the top of our voices.
Had you given orders to shout, or did they just do it spontaneously?
Spontaneously.
How big were the bayonets?
About a foot a bayonet. But it is quite a frightening thing to see that steel. It's not so frightening seeing a weapon facing you as a bit of steel. And fortunately, I have not seen it the opposite way on. I've only seen it during bayonet training.
Were they firing at you as you charged?
They were firing at us while we charged. And that day we probably lost some 30 people killed and wounded.
In the charge?
In the charge. Now, later on, we had an unfortunate situation where an enemy mortar bomb landed in our headquarters near a mule that had a flamethrower on it. And the flamethrower canister of fuel got on fire and set fire to the jungle. And being in a dry area, we had to move very rapidly to a new area. We knew at that stage we were not going to get through to Indore, and we'd had a report that we were to withdraw because the Japanese had reinforced Indore. And that next 48 hours was a very memorable area in a dry area with no water. And we were in a defensive bivouac with wounded crying out for water, and we had to dig in some of the dry chongs and get a few pints of water at a time just to feed the prisoners of war, just to feed the wounded. Whereas our own people, some of them, got to the stage, foolishly, of drinking their own urine. So...
Why foolishly?
Well, if you drink your own urine, it's so full of salt, you get even thirstier in no time. So the next day it was decided that the whole column must leave and make a move eastwards to an area where we could expect water. The people we had with us, for instance, we had a platoon of Burma rifles, Burmese, who were extremely jungle wise and said that if we moved some 4 miles to the east, we could find water. Our area was surrounded by Japanese, and as I commanded the rifle company, I said that I would hold an area in the jungle, a passageway for the rest of the column and mules to get out, and wait till everyone had gone out before gradually withdrawing a platoon at a time. By the time we came to the last platoon, we had run out of ammunition. We had run out of ammunition, and I stayed behind with the next section, and I realized that the column was too far away to catch up, and I must try to get back to a stronghold called Aberdeen, some 30 miles away. No ammunition, and moving through the jungle and seeing Japanese wounded and dead all around us, I realised we were going to be in deep trouble if the Japs got hold of us, because they probably would not just kill us, they would torture us. After we'd gone for a quarter of a mile, the sound of the teak leaves, and the dry teak leaves almost the size of an elephant's ear, crackled so much that I knew the Japanese would be able to follow us that way. So I told my 10 men that we would dive into a dry chong, cover ourselves with leaves, teak leaves, and lay there, and not to move a muscle. And that the most difficult thing was to stay that way when we knew the Japs were 5 or 10 yards away. Fortunately, they did it, and after 2 hours, and we heard them searching and jabbering with anger, darkness came and we were able to slip away.
So you were in a way like a rear guard?
I stayed with the last section to see everyone away. Now, if this rear guard had got up and moved away, immediately the last people moved off, it would have been a failure. I had to stop with that last section and allow the people to be away at least a quarter of a mile away through the jungle to hold off the Japs.
And where was this, did you say?
This was some 3 miles from this village Thekkajin, but it was in a dry area where there was no water.
Which month would this have been?
This was in April.
44.
April 44.
And was the Bernard charge also in April?
In April, yes. The day after I moved off with this last part of the rear guard of 10 people without ammunition, a commentary on human nature, where I can compare the intense comradeship I experienced in Burma, the like of which I've never experienced again, and yet at the same time, what the effect of intense fear is in terms of human survival. The day after we'd hidden under the teak leaves, one of our men was coughing, and after a while the rest of the section said, "We can't go on like this. This man is going to give us away. We're all going to be killed. We must kill him for our own sakes." And I remember to this day that poor man on the floor coughing and looking at me with piteous eyes to see what I would say. Of course, I said something like hell you will. We will move and we will live and die together. And when we got to safety, I know they were all pleased.
You were telling me earlier that you operated in pairs, that you had a maka.
Yes. Whenever we stopped for a meal, we made little tiny fires, having picked up dry wood and leaves during the daytime, sufficient to make a little fire to heat our K rations, and dry leaves and dry wood so there'd be no smoke coming out of the jungle. Everyone cooked their meals in twos. Everyone slept in their own ground sheet, side by side with their same mukka, comrade, at night time, side by side in two ground sheets. And in a defensive bivouac, everyone was positioned with his mate. It gave people a tremendous feeling of having someone who they must look after rather than themselves. A great feeling and great sense of responsibility and great satisfaction.
I interrupted you with you giving the story of you acting as the rear guard and taking cover under the leaves.
When we took cover under the leaves, I think I've mentioned this before to you, haven't I? That the Japanese were searching for us all around and jabbering with rage because 100 yards away there were about 10 of their dead and 20 of their wounded lying out on the ground. And I told my other nine that it required great forbearance to hide in this chong with teak leaves over them and not let fear take over and get up and run. I said it was a great test of their willpower, but I said if they didn't, they would not survive. And fortunately, they did it. They stayed there for 2 hours until night fell. And then we moved off in safety. I think I have told you about the man who was coughing, and our next great experience was when Aberdeen, the stronghold which we got to, where 2 days later, my own column, 5-4 column, arrived to report that I had been killed and the rear guard had been killed. And I emerged and said, I'm not dead yet. Nor are the other nine. We're all here. After 48 hours of re-equipping there, and this Aberdeen stronghold was protected by a force of from a Nigerian battalion, we were called on to go and help 77 Brigade, who had been surrounded at White City since late in April. They'd been attacked practically every night, and we were to go over and attack the attackers. And this is where I first met Brigadier Calvert, who somehow rode out on a charger, a grey charger, through the jungle and came to us some 5 miles away from White City, which was a dug-in stronghold in a few jungle hills, and told us what we had to do, and then rode back. He must have had, with his Burmese guide, a secret way through the jungle. The next day, we attacked the attackers. We attacked the Japs who were trying to break in to White City, which was so called by the number of white parachutes festooned in the trees, where they had supply drops over 3 or 4 weeks of wire, food, ammunition, etc. And that morning, we fought for 4 hours against the Japanese, and I remember one particular moment where one of my platoon commanders, called Tony Musselwhite, was by my side. We were squatting down in the jungle, giving orders to the various platoons, and he said, they shot my finger off. And here's a hale, hearty and strong man. He said, they've shot my finger off, and he died of shock in 30 seconds. There was nothing wrong with him except sheer shock. During that morning, we lost some 150 dead. This was the intensest battle of the whole time we had in Burma, and a fairly large proportion of wounded. And at shortly after midday, we got the orders to withdraw, and that night on the signal, we heard that the Japanese had withdrawn from surrounding the White City at the same time as we'd withdrawn. So, although we had a tremendous lot of casualties, the attack had done its job. And 77 Brigade eventually got out of White City and finished up at a major battle in Mogong, which was another famous victory, before they eventually flew out.
What did you think of the Japanese performance at White City and their general soldierliness when you got into combat with them?
It's very difficult to say a man is a smart soldier when you're in a thick jungle, and some of this scrub was called lantana, which means the little shoots go right down to the ground. You crawl underneath it and slash a bit as you go out. All I can say is the Japanese would never give up. And there's one occasion where a Japanese prisoner at night time, with the edge of open bully beef tin, committed suicide at night, sawing his own throat with a tin of bully beef. Such was their desire, if they were wounded, to die and ensure their family wasn't looked down upon back in Japan. This is part of their code.
How did you know that he had killed himself with the bully beef tin? Did you see him?
No, but here he is dead, and the bully beef tin was by his side and blood on the jagged edge.
But you saw the corpse?
We saw the corpse.
Where was that?
This was within a mile or two of White City.
Was he an officer or a soldier?
Just a soldier.
What was your attitude towards the Japanese enemy? Did you respect them or hate them or what?
I personally just knew I didn't hate them, didn't respect them. I knew they were someone I got to kill. Didn't even think. I knew it was someone I got to kill.
So it was purely professional?
Purely professional. Later on, and I must say that I am surprised that some people still have this lingering hatred of the Japanese, and I feel sometimes it is a lingering hatred on the part of people who don't really know the Japanese. Because, in fact, when a Japanese soldier is wounded, they are just as cruel to their own wounded as they are to our wounded. They have no time for them anymore. That is their philosophy. And I found this later on when I dropped into a prisoner war camp, which I may come on to, they were just as cruel to their own sick people as to their own, as to the sick prisoners of war.
Would you have taken Japanese prisoners?
On the whole, I think it was very foolish to take Japanese prisoners because one knew, A, of their suicidal tendencies, and B, they would do anything to kill whoever had taken them prisoner rather than survive and be taken away to captivity elsewhere.
So you mean you were taking a great risk?
One would be taking a great risk, and you would need to have several men to guard one prisoner.
But were prisoners taken in the event?
Very few prisoners were taken. After this bully beef incident, we certainly found that everyone in battle was killed, never seen to be taken prisoner.
Did you ever see any prisoners?
No.